This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
I'm Tom Wilmer, and I'm here with Heidi Brandes. Heidi leads a multiplicity of lives. She's a belly dancer, an international travel journalist, and a medieval warrior.
Hi, Tom.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and belly dancing.
Like you said, I am a journalist. I've been a journalist for about 20 years and from Oklahoma City. I joined a group that recreates the better parts of the Middle Ages. It's a group called the Society for Creative Anachronism. And I used to see belly dancers there. And imagine me, I'm like 21 years old, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, not even out of college yet. And I'm looking at these women in the woods dancing the live music around bonfires. I remember thinking, that has got to be the prettiest, most sensual, most feminine thing I'd ever seen. Oh, I could never do that. And then I'd see belly dancers at the state fair. And again, I'd just stare at them, just transfixed. And oh, I could never do that. Well, when I turned about 27, I had a friend call me, said, I'm going to take belly dance classes in Oklahoma City. Will you join me? I said, yes, absolutely. And Tom, I was terrible. I was the most awkward-looking white girl dancing belly dancer you've ever seen. But, you know, I stuck with it. And 20 years later, now I help run the studio.
And so you teach belly dancing?
I teach it now. I teach it. I have won awards. Our Oklahoma City studio, the Alim Dance Academy of Oklahoma City, has won numerous national and international dance awards now, myself included. So I like to tell ladies who start, if I can learn how to do it, anyone can learn how to do it.
You did it. We travel together, and in idle moments, you tell me stories about the world of belly dancing and the cultural nuances and the distinctive characteristics from country to country. I find that most fascinating.
I do too. And, you know, when you first start belly dancing, or when you hear the word belly dancing, you're thinking of the girls in the glittery costumes showing their navels. But there's so much more to it than that. I mean, I've been in classes for at least 3 hours a week, sometimes up to 6 hours a week for the last 20 years of my life. And I still don't know everything there is to know about belly dance. Because when you say belly dance, it's a catch-all phrase. You've got, you know, Egyptian style. You've got Upper and Lower Nile dances. You've got dances from Saudi Arabia, from Lebanon, dances from, you know, Persian dances, and everything in between. And each one has their very cultural music, the dances that go with that music, certain moves that are indicative in costumes that are indicative to that.
There are things that are very different from country to country, but other things that are universal. Tell us about some of the distinctive characteristics.
Well, of course, belly dance is a dance created by women for women, though there are plenty of men who do it now, and they do it beautifully as well. But, you know, you keep thinking of that Hollywood scene where the belly dancer is dancing in front of the sheik, and it's all very sensual. And that really rarely happened. What would happen is women would dance for each other. It was a way to bond. It was a way to, you know, have friendships. And some think way to teach younger women how to give birth easily. Because, you know, you have the belly rolls, you know, it's like pushing out a baby and stretching out the hips. But there's this kind of sisterhood to it. I mean, even now, you walk into any studio, there's an instant bond with ladies learning how to do this dance. And the best part about it is you don't have to be size one. You don't have to be a certain height. I have ladies in my class who are size 1 to a size 21. I have women in my class that are age 7 to 97.
So and whether you have a belly or not.
In fact, if you have a little belly, it actually works. If you notice, Tom, I have a little bit of belly here, too.
So that's a bonus.
And when I shimmy, ooh, it likes to dance, too. And yeah, that's a bonus.
I remember you telling me you feel an affinity for the Lebanese style of
I belly.
Do. Okay.
Lebanese and Turkish style, which is odd because the core group of us in the studio all learn from the same woman. A woman named Soraya El-Musri, and she's taught Egyptian-style belly dance. But your own personality comes through. I tend to be, I don't know if you noticed, Tom, kind of wild, outgoing, kind of flamboyant personality. And the Turkish and Lebanese style tends to be a little bigger, you know. Egyptian is very controlled movements, very small, controlled. And Lebanese and Turkish is a little wilder. So I tend to lean towards that.
Interesting. A lot of people assume there's a sexual undertones, but not necessarily
No, not necessarily. In fact, you know, we like to say that it's, there's a sensual undertone. Sexy means, you know, you're showing off your wares in the hopes of seducing somebody.
But like you said, it was originally women for women.
Yeah, and even to this day, because we dance in restaurants and hookah bars throughout Oklahoma and beyond, and the people who tip us the most and applaud the most and get up and dance with us are women and kids, especially kids. Kids love belly dancers. I think it's because we sparkle so much. But the women do, too. The men, especially American men, they tend to look a little nervous at first because they don't know if they're supposed to be looking at us or not.
A little intimidated. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll pull the women up and dance, and I think they enjoy it because they recognize that it is a beautiful way to move, and they can visualize themselves doing it. So like I said, if you're a woman, you can do this dance. It was created by us for us.
Tell us a little bit more about the cultural distinctive characteristics from country to country and how you could tell by watching a belly dancer.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, you know, like Egyptian is very controlled. They're very small, tight movements. Also very sensual, but you can tell difference between that and Lebanese. Lebanese, very big movements, you know, a lot of hair tosses and sways. Then you get into very folkloric dances. In Saudi Arabia, you have something called Khaliji. And you're covered from head to toe, basically, with these big, giant, they almost look like muumuu dresses, except for they're gorgeous. But because you're not showing off your belly and stuff, you really have to move the dress, and you're popping your chest, and you're moving the dress, and while you're doing that, you're doing this very distinctive, like, little half step, and then you're flipping your hair at the same time, and you have to do all that without falling down, look graceful, and smile. So it was actually one of the hardest dances I've ever had to learn. But, you know, there's Khaliji, there's Saidi, there's Mazmoudi, I mean, Shiftetelli, all these beats have their own dances and rhythms. So, you know, you see people go, oh, you're just out there wiggling your butt. And you're like, no, you know, you have to study because, you know, you don't want to do a Turkish dance to a Persian piece of music. That's a huge no-no. You know, God forbid you're in a Persian restaurant, you play Turkish music, they will, no. So you have to learn the differences between all this, and you have to respect the culture. You know, there's a lot of talk about cultural appropriation. Me as an American, French, German woman, do I have the right to do belly dancing? And I like to say yes, because I'm not just renting a tape, watching it for 2 hours, and going out and calling myself a belly dancer. I mean, this is 20 years of study. So, like everything else, respect the culture and learn the culture.
In Hawaii, as you know, the hula is very much a communication, sending signals with arms and hands and fingers. Oh, does that apply in the belly dance? Tell us about that.
There are some. I mean, you go along the Nile and you'll have Phoenician pot dances. They tell a story. So there are certain dances that you kind of expect, okay, this is the story of the ladies all coming to the well to fill their pots, and they gossip, and they have the little, you know, hand movements to their face like they're gossiping. So you can pick up on these kind of cultural stories, but all dance should tell a story. All art should tell a story. You know, you look at a painting, what is the story there? The artist who creates it has a story in head, but what you see is a different story. Same way with dance. When I dance, I'm telling a story with my body, with my emotions, with my hand movements. And what the audience sees is a story that they're interpreting by watching me.
As an outsider looking in, there is something, as you said, so sensual about belly dance. Therefore, implicit in my mind, is there something implicitly sexual? But
yeah.
Learning from you, not necessarily so.
Yeah, not necessarily. I mean, granted, modern-day costumes, what you visualize when you think belly dancer, they are designed to accentuate the best parts of a woman's body. And they do that very well. So, you know, there's
by default, there is a sexual
component. Yeah, there is. I mean, you do look beautiful. And women, all shapes and sizes, when they wear it, they feel beautiful. When you feel beautiful, when you feel that confidence in yourself, there's a power to it. I consider a very sensual feminine power. A lot of people may look at it and see it as very sexual, but we're not doing sexual moves. We're not gyrating on audience members. That would be a huge no-no. You know, very rarely in traditional dance do you dance open-legged. You always have a closed leg. So there's modesty aspects of it. But no, it's not like we're going out there trying to be lewd, like shaking the girls in people's faces. You know, You shake your shoulders. You know, the girls are just along for the ride, you know.
So tell us about stories from the front lines.
Yeah. Like everything else, you have your very funny stories, especially when you're first starting out. And it was in my like third year of belly dancing. We were doing a huge show at a hospital for all the staff. It was International Day there. There were 100 people in the audience. And I'm with my little troupe, and I'm about a beginner belly dancer, and we're dancing. We're doing great. And we turn. I feel something pop on my costume. I'm like, but things pop all the time. So we keep dancing. I turn again. Something popped, and my skirt and my belt fall straight to the ground. And I am standing there in front of 100 people in my underwear. If you ever hear 100 people gasp in horror on your behalf, it's a sound that haunts you years later. So not only was I sitting there in my underwear, I was sitting there in the ugliest, rattiest, granny pantiest pair of underwear I had. So I picked up my skirt, ran to the back of the stage, and everybody's helping me put it on. I'm bent over, and everybody's freaking out. And they're like, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to go back out there. So I stand up really fast, and I headbutt the girl next to me, behind me, right in the eye. She goes down, much like my skirt did on the stage. I just went, sorry. I ran out there, and what else are you going to do? I kind of did one of those, ta-da, here I am things, and the crowd went wild. And so I kept dancing. Everybody applauded. And I think, you know, your audience will be very forgiving when they see something, because they don't want to see you mess up. But if you come back out and you're like, hey, here I am, woohoo, then they love you for it. Sadly, the girl I headbutted, she had to go on right afterwards. And as she's dancing, she's doing this beautiful dance. And as she's dancing, her eye is swelling and turning black. And she had a black eye for 3 weeks.
Wow.
Little funny stories like that. We had a girl in a competition. We got third place in the Las Vegas Wiggles of the West competition. And as soon as she stepped on stage, she stepped on a needle.
Oh.
And she danced our entire 7-minute routine with a needle stuck in her foot and never broke stride.
True trooper.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, you know, throughout the ages, little things that happen in restaurants. And I had one little boy, very misbehaved little boy, come up behind me in a restaurant, grab my belt, pull and sit down, and pull my belt and everything underneath my belt down under my bottom. So I'm sitting there bare bottomed in the middle of this restaurant trying to swat this boy off of me. So yeah, there are the little foibles and funny stories. You know, when you come to see a belly dancer, when we're friendly, it's intimidating to be up in front of people half dressed dancing something that you're so passionate about. But we tell people there's certain etiquette. One, look at us and smile. We're here to entertain you. Two, when you tip us, if you're allowed to tip, only tip in the belt. And that's kind of paying homage to the belly dancers of old, because they used to sew their money into their belts. Never try to tip a belly dancer in her chops, a big no-no. You know, if you're ever curious, try it out. If you're a woman or even a man nowadays, come and try it. It is a beautiful way to exercise. And when we have women who have knee problems, back problems, weight problems, and they all dance.
I love it. Heidi Brandis, thanks for sharing.
Well, thank you, Tom.
My pleasure. Always a joy to be with you. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Tennessee, actually, today.
Yes, we're both in Tennessee together.
I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me as we visit with Marcus Coker. Marcus is from Fort Smith, Arkansas. One of the things I find most fascinating about Marcus is his passion for dance. Not just any dance, but swing dance, big band dance, classic dance of Americana. Marcus.
Hi, Tom. It's really lovely to be here with you.
My pleasure, and it's so fascinating. As you know, I love learning about all kinds of different things. I just interviewed a belly dancer. And as we both share a passion for the big band era, for that era of classy dress and classy dance and classy music, it's wonderful to meet you and have you share your passion and what's so special about it. How did you get interested in swing dance?
You know, I did not start dancing at all until I was in college, and I just started college, and I had some friends that were still in high school that heard about a swing class at a local dance studio, and they decided to go, and one of the guys and I worked together, and he said, you should go to this swing dance class. I had no idea what it was. I did not grow up dancing whatsoever, and it just sounded like something fun to do. So I went, my sister went with me, she was my first dance partner, and I loved it.
What made you like it?
For one thing, I had a really wonderful teacher. She was very vibrant and enthusiastic, and her personality matched swing dancing of all the dances. Now I love all sorts of dances, but I started with swing. It's still my favorite. Swing is upbeat. It's the only dance that has a literal pulse to it. You bend your knees and you bounce up and down, and it is full of energy in life. It matches the music, big band music, 50s, 60s rock and roll, soul music. It's got a punch that makes you want to tap your feet and move your body.
You took your class and you got hooked.
I got hooked. All of my friends, 6 months into it, had stopped taking, but my sister and I continued to take. We became friends with the teacher. And when she moved, she was a radio DJ and got another job somewhere else. She recommended that I start teaching. By that time, we'd moved to a local fitness center, and we made arrangements with the fitness center for me to teach 2 or 3 classes a week. So for a long time, it was like I was still learning as I was going along and teaching, and then eventually I opened my own studio. I just sort of fell into it, and it was one of the best things that's ever happened.
Tell us a little bit more about what swing dance is and how symbolic it is and was in a period of American history when it was the rage, and why and how it continues today.
Lindy Hop is sort of the grandfather of all swing dances. It grew out of the Charleston. Lindy Hop came about in the 1930s and 40s, and it was named in honor of Charles Lindbergh and his hop across the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. It largely developed in the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem in New York City, which was one of the only places where blacks and whites danced together. It really swept the nation. It's one of the few dances that came strictly from America, but now it's worldwide. It sort of disappeared for a little while, just into small circles, and then it had a resurgence in the 80s and 90s, and now you find it all over the globe.
Talk to us about the distinctive nuances of swing, like you said, the rhythm and the beat and the pulse and whatnot, and the symmetry.
A lot of dances, like ballroom and Latin dances, even country dances, partner style dances, which is what I'm interested in, involves two people working together. What's unique about swing is that while you're working together, both people get to express themselves individually. So even though like there's a basic structure, but each person kind of gets to add on to, or we say improvise, stylize it in their own way. So when you watch Lindy Hoppers or swing dancers dance, each couple's going to look a little different. And even within a partnership, each person is going to look a little different because they're hearing different things in the music. Swing music and swing dancing allows for a lot of personal interpretation. Sometimes it's referred to as a street dance or kind of an earthy dance. It's not as maybe refined as some of the other dances. And you really get that feel with the music. Swing music is a little, it's jazz music, you know, it's a little unpredictable. It's a little freer, and that's what I feel when I swing dance, is a sense of freedom that I don't feel just walking along the street every day.
And you were contrasting it the other day to foxtrot, for example.
Right. So the foxtrot and swing both use swing music. Like, take a Frank Sinatra song, which is swing music. It has a swing rhythm.
Can you define what is swing rhythm?
That is a toughie, and it took me, I was probably 10 years into it before I heard it explained very well. In regular music, you might count the beat 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And if you're going to count the space in between the whole numbers, you would call it an and it would be 1, 2, 3, 4. And in swing, that and, it's still called an and, but it's, this is not always true, but it's mostly true. It's about two-thirds of the way over instead of halfway over. And so it's 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 and 6. So it's a little delayed.
Is that literally translated to your body movements?
Yes, it is. So when you dance, ideally, if you're doing it right, you're stepping on the beats or on the half beats. When you watch swing dancers, you see that delay so that their body movements are matching what you hear in the music, like the underlying beat. Or sometimes they're identifying with the vocalist. They're expressing their bodies to match the lyrics.
It's a paradox in a way, listening to you, in that you're totally syncopated. You're moving in time to the rhythm and the beat, but yet you were alluding to the individual expression within that.
Right. Yeah, and that's the fascinating thing about it. Paradox is a very good word, because you're working together. There's a foundation that you're both connected to, but then there's so much room for little nuances and how you express yourself. Maybe how you move your arms or shrug your shoulders or a facial expression, or maybe you pause in the music while you're dancing to match the music. It's really playful, probably more than any other dance that I'm aware of. It is a playful dance. It's a fun dance.
As I watch swing dance, there's this anticipatory thing going on between the partners where you have to anticipate where your partner's going to go.
Sometimes in dancing, what's most common is we use the term lead and follow. And lead is stereotypically the male, and follow is stereotypically the female, but that is not
necessarily so.
Not necessarily so. There are a lot of females that lead, there are a lot of males that follow, or do both. And so one of my ballroom dancers says sometimes a better way to say it is that you have someone who initiates a movement and someone who executes a movement. Again, using the typical terms, a leader is usually the one that initiates a movement. But a lot of times, especially in swing dance, because it's more playful, a follower will execute a movement. So one of the good things about dancing is that it teaches you to pay attention to your partner and what's going on, because it really is a conversation. That's a great way to think of it. Just like you and I are talking now, one person says something, the other person listens, and back and forth. Sometimes you both say something at the same time.
So it all very much is in the moment.
It's very much in the moment, and you never know what's going to happen. You get out there, you might be dancing to a song you've heard 100 times, and it's different every time that you dance it, based on the mood you're in, the things you're picking up in the music, the person you're dancing with, maybe the band that's interpreting the song. And I think that that's really beautiful, because you get to create something, you get to become part of the music, the whole experience. And you're not just dancing with the person that you're holding hands with, you're dancing with everyone else on the floor, paying attention to where everyone else is, and interacting with them too. It's pretty magical. It can be frustrating when you're learning, but it's pretty magical.
So on the one hand, things are choreographed, but yet it's in the moment, right? So it's semi-paradoxical again.
Right. So if you're watching Dancing with the Stars, then the routines that you see on there are all choreographed. They're planned out. They work on them throughout the week. They know we're going to do this move, and then we're going to do this move, and then we're going to pause, and we're going to do a backflip or whatever it is. You can do that in swing. You can have choreographed routines for performances and entertainment. When you're social dancing, you don't know any of that. You have certain patterns and shapes and sort of rules that you're following in the dance, but as a leader, you're thinking, what am I going to do next? What am I going to do next? And as a follower, you're just trying to pay attention and see where it goes. Exactly. And so a lot of times people see social dancers, they think, that had to be planned out.
And yet it wasn't.
And yet it wasn't. Yeah, and that's the cool thing about it.
And that's one of the reasons you like it.
I do. It is, I think, one of my favorite things about swing dancing in particular is that magic that can happen between you and another person in the moment. It's not planned for. You know, you and I are both writers, and sometimes you sit down in the moment, you don't know what you're going to say, and that you're two paragraphs in, something cool comes out, you go, where did that come from? It's the same thing on the dance floor.
Let's talk about classic swing tunes and which ones, you know, would be your theme song.
Wow.
If we were to swing dance tonight and we had a band here, what would you ask them to play?
Oh, I'd probably ask him to play some Ella Fitzgerald song. Personally, I love the music that came a little bit later in the 50s and 60s. I love rock and roll beat, like a soul music beat. I love music by Sam Cooke. One of my favorite ones that I've been playing over and over just recently is called Movin' and Groovin' by Sam Cooke. It's got a lot of soul to it. And that's what makes my feet want to move. Some of the classic tunes, though, of course, by Count Basie and Duke Ellington, you just can't go wrong.
Benny Goodman.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Tommy Dorsey, yeah. Glenn Miller, of course. A lot of times people think of, you know, In the Mood by Glenn Miller. And
that era is like pure romance, mm-hmm. Consummate romance.
Yeah, and you know, like you were talking about earlier, there's that classiness about it. You go to a swing dance, there's nothing like walking into a room and seeing hundreds of people swing dance or Lindy Hop. And a lot of the events, this has kind of changed over the last 20 years, for the better, I think, but at a lot of events now, the guys wear high-waisted pants, the girls wear the vintage dresses and put their hair up in freedom rolls, I think is what they're called. But it's a class act. I mean, it's like stepping back in time. I mean, there's something about dressing up, you know, you feel better about yourself.
Stepping out.
Yeah, stepping out, that's right. Exactly. So it is a really unique thing to be a part of. Having owned a dance studio for quite a while and been around dancers for a while, I hear a lot of, I would love to do that, but I have two left feet, or I could never do that. And what I know is that some people are inclined toward it and excel faster. They pick it up quicker. Anyone can get better. I've yet
to turn people around.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I have, but maybe I've helped, and they've I think anyone who wants to learn can. I had a student who really had a hard time with the beat. He just couldn't hear it. It was tough for him, but he was determined. He came a couple times a week for a year. At 80% of the time he was on beat, and when he started it was maybe 10. So it's just a matter of if you want to, if you're interested in it, you can definitely do it. Two left feet is an excuse. You know, I think a lot of guys are afraid of how they might look in front of their girlfriends or wives. But dancing is, I've heard it described as full body vulnerability. It's a big deal. It's a big deal for people just to show up and take a class. It's a big deal to keep coming back. And it's a big deal to not get something right away. There's so much that's going on. You know, when you play the organ, which I don't, but I have a friend that does, and your right hand's doing one thing, your left hand's doing another, your right foot's doing another, and your left foot's doing another. And in dance, it's kind of the same thing. Like, you've got multiple things going on at one time, so it's a lot to coordinate. You can just work on it, like, piece by piece by piece. So setting the bar low and just having a good time is a good way to approach it. So I've been doing this for about 20 years, personally as a hobby, and then also professionally as a teacher. There are moments when dance is really frustrating. You walk into a place and you think, gosh, I've been doing this for 20 years and everybody here is better than I am, and I don't know anybody. And it's still intimidating after 20 years to walk into a room, like if I'm traveling out of town and go to a local dance, it's still intimidating to go up and ask, especially someone that I think is an excellent dancer, to dance. So that's part of it. But what dance, I think, gives a person, has the ability to give a person, no matter where I go, I can go to a local dance and most likely have a good time. It's a great way to meet people. It's a wonderful way to exercise. You can do it by yourself. You can do it with your partner, someone you care about. It's wonderful for so many reasons. There are all these studies about, you know, because you're using so many parts of your body at one time, like what it does for your brain and your health and all of that. But it really just boils down to it's really fun. So I would highly recommend to anybody who wants to give it a shot to just make it happen and enjoy yourselves.
Marcus Coker, thanks for sharing.
Tom, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.